Hello, and welcome to episode 210 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I am joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
I want to admit something in today's show at the start. I almost always roll my eyes at life advice memes that I see online, and frankly, I see them a lot. They tend to be oversimplified, cliche, or just plain nonsense. But I came across one recently that really struck me. In fact, I thought it was such good advice that I decided to rewrite it a bit for the show and make it our topic today. And rewriting it, as you'll soon see, is kind of fitting since the whole point about this is reframing. The idea goes like this. The past doesn't actually exist anymore. It only lives in our memories. And memories aren't exact. They're colored by emotion, exaggeration, and even what we forget. Two people can experience the same thing and remember it quite differently. So the past is less about facts and more about the story we tell ourselves. And if that story no longer serves us, we can simply rewrite it. And in rewriting our past, we can reshape who we are today. Rick, that's where we'll begin today's conversation. When you hear that, what does it mean to reframe our memories? And do you think there are ethical and personal implications when we do so?
Well, I'll tell you what, Scott, listening to you read that passage, I'm both troubled by certain implications, certain ways of taking it, and also the other ways of taking it, I think, are great. Exactly. First of all, to say that the past doesn't really exist, it just lives in our memories, I think that's wrong. I think there is a real past. Now, the way we access the past is always through some kind of narrative, some kind of story. And so we do have a lot of power to reshape or reframe the ways in which we think about the past and even the ways in which we perceive it, the way we picture it. But I also think we have a responsibility not to kind of rewrite our own past just in ways that is convenient to us or suits us. And I'll give you an example.
Yeah,
there's a moral or an ethical objection to this. One of my favorite movies is Crimes and Misdemeanors. It was a Woody Allen film from mid-1980s.
Yeah, I've heard of it, but I don't think I've ever seen it.
Yeah, Martin Landau plays this. He's an ophthalmologist who has an affair with one of his, it's not one of his patients, but someone he meets on an airplane, has an affair with her, and then eventually, like, she wants much more of the relationship, and she's threatening to tell his wife, and that would expose him professionally. And so he ends up hiring a hitman to kill her. He does this in a roundabout way through a brother-in-law or somebody that's involved with the mob and never really specifies exactly what he wants. And he's able, by the end of the movie, to kind of convince himself that that's not really what he did, and not to think about it in the same way. And
but she's dead.
She's dead. I mean, yeah, he absolutely kills her, but he finds a way of kind of absolving himself of guilt. And he has this amazing discussion at the end where he sits down with the character played by Woody Allen at a wedding. They're both at a wedding, and they're reflecting on things. And he says, I have this brilliant plot for a movie, and it's a movie in which somebody commits a murder. They get away with it, and nothing happens. And after a long time of thinking that they're going to get caught and thinking that everything will be exposed, they gradually find out, like, everybody's forgotten about it, and nothing happens, and their life goes on pretty much as normal. And Woody Allen says, but I don't like that, because where's the justice? Where's the resolution? Like, the one who commits a crime has to be punished in order for there to be an ending. And the Martin Landau character says, yeah, but that's movies. I'm talking about real life. And in real life, things fade and you stop thinking about things. And pretty soon, things just return to the way they were. And it's really troubling because I think it does highlight something that really significant about the human capacity for self-deception, for like really rewriting our past in ways in which we are no longer fully responsible for certain things that we actually did and should pay some kind of recompense for. And so I don't like, like if it's that, if it means like, if the past is inconvenient, we're able to rewrite it because it doesn't really exist. It's like, well,
somebody's dead.
Somebody's dead. Yeah. And like, and that's a real fact. That's not, that doesn't exist only in your memory. That exists like in fact. But I'll say this, but if the rewriting or the reframing means we have a lot of power over like our perspective on things. And it's possible sometimes when we're ruminating on something, when there's something that's like really destructive and counterproductive in our life, that we have the power sometimes of changing how we feel about it in ways that can maybe make us advance and let us live healthier and happier lives. I'm all for that.
Yeah, and I want to go on the record as saying that I think murder is bad. I'm
but also theft and betrayal and all these.
That I think there are things that are like bad that people should do, and you know, and I also want to like, I think you could hear what I read at the beginning of the show and say, well, then he doesn't feel like history is important. There are lessons that we can learn from the atrocities of World War II and those things. Absolutely. That's not what I'm talking about. Right. Is that there are things, you know, I suppose good too. Like, you know, we've made remarkable technological advances and people are living healthier lives than they were 100 years ago. We should also be aware of that and realize that our lives today in many, many cases are better and easier because of like simple things like clean water and air and modern technology. So, I mean, I don't want to like scrub those things away.
Let me give you something a little more nuanced and complicated. So like think of all the people who at some point, probably thousands of people who were guests of Jeffrey Epstein.
Oh, sure. Yes.
And they come in there as their guests and there's something kind of creepy going on, but they don't ask questions. But, you know, they like the connection with this person who's a celebrity or other celebrity. And then they find out later about like really what was happening and how awful that was and the effect on people's lives. But they kind of rewrite for themselves, well, I didn't really know what was going on. And they kind of absolve themselves for any responsibility that they might have had at the time to expose this, where they had a real ability to act. I think this is where the power of self-deception is really evident in these cases where we make ourselves feel more comfortable with something bad that happened, especially in cases where we aren't directly responsible, but we bear some kind of, say, shared responsibility.
And I guess to me, the question is, as a society today, do we have more people doing what you describe, you know, saying, gosh, I had done these not good things in the past. I'm not murdering someone or involved in a pedophilia ring, but I mean like doing things that you're not proud of and then just sort of not taking real ownership or responsibility of those things and trying to move on and live a good, happy life and kind of scrub away the past? Or do you think we have more of society today that is, that just can't get over something that maybe someone did to them? That something that they may have done that was hurtful to someone else that they're just still ruminating on years and years later and just can't get past. I just, in many ways, feel like the second is oftentimes a bigger stopping point for more people, is that they're just can't seem to move on from something that it's probably time to move on from.
Yeah, I think both.
Okay.
I think we have a huge capacity for deceiving ourselves in ways that absolve us from responsibility so that we quit thinking of the ways in which we're guilty, and then that stops us from ever taking any action to make things right. But we also have problems of getting over, especially harms that were done to us, and to continue to ruminate on them. Sometimes I think we also maybe spend too long in the stage of regret about like things that we should have done differently, but keep where it's not possible to do anything more. So I think that's all possible. It's how do you quantify it? Like what is more of a problem?
What is more of a problem? But I mean, how much of that quantifying is what's going to make my life better moving forward? And I think that if you continually are doing bad things and just like shrugging your shoulders and say, well, I'll just try to do better next time, that probably is not going to lead to a happy and fulfilled life.
But I think the question has to be, what is going to make our life better going forward?
Yes, yes.
Right. And generally, I think that's a pretty good guide, because if you ask, what is going to make our life, like what is going to make my life, say, within my family, within my circle of friends, within my community, what's going to make us all happier and more productive and get along and trust one another better? Generally, reframing things in ways that helps us all live better together is going to be a positive way of reframing it. If it's going to be something that benefits my own conception of myself, but at the cost of improving our relationships, then it's probably an unethical or not constructive way of reframing.
And a lot of this, when I was thinking about this, at least, was thinking about, I guess, holding grudges and how that, you know, because let's say somebody had wronged you at some point, and that person, you know, probably deep down knows they did something that was harmful in some way, and I'm using harm. We can interpret that in a small way or in a pretty significant way. But that person is now out of your life. I mean, there's times where that, you know, it could be somebody much older and could be dead. And at some point, you just need to realize that this harm is in the past, and you do need to, you know, and I guess there's a story, then we'll link to it in the show notes, that talks about how really the purpose of, in many cases, of forgiveness is less about forgiving the person, but more about changing how we carry that memory in a way. And I think that's what really sort of rang true to me, is that if you have these memories about, you know, I'm making this up, this was not my experience, but let's say you had a childhood that wasn't great, and maybe there was some physical abuse from time to time, and your parents are no longer around, and you can probably think of a dozen different places where you wish somebody would have stepped in and done something about it, but you're doing with your own kids, absolutely not repeating these same mistakes. At some point, you just kind of need to let go of this, right? I mean, I know that sounds, and I guess why I hesitate to even say this, is it just sounds like, I'm making it sound so easy. Like, oh, well, you know, your dad beat you up a few times, but, you know, just get over it. I mean, that's not easy, but at some time you have to try, right?
Yeah, it's not easy. And you're right about the letting go part, I think, is really the first step in forgiveness. You can't simply forgive somebody for doing, if somebody has caused you real harm, you can't simply forgive them without a kind of emotional reframing of the situation. And I wrote a paper on this years ago where I talked about the concept of psychical distance. That is, there are ways of distancing yourself from the immediacy of the harm that was done to you by trying to observe the situation as if you are a spectator on the action that happened. We find in many cases, like, this is one way in which art can be very healing.
Yeah.
We find, like in South Africa, one of the things that was done following the dismantling of apartheid was a holding of different public performances in which many of the harms that were conducted during the period of apartheid were done are kind of displayed in the theater, in which people would come and watch them. And so instead of just thinking about the way in which this was done to me and feeling like the immediacy of the emotion, I'm observing it out there as if, you know, it's on the stage. And there's a psychological distance to that where I'm the spectator. And so I'm just observing it. And what it helps is it allows people to have a different perspective. Rwanda does the same thing following the genocide in Rwanda. They had plays and you find this happening with other kinds of artworks. You find it happening with poetry and music and painting. People who've been victims of certain kinds of crimes, often violent crimes, can often find themselves experiencing some kind of healing through art. I mean, it's remarkable because what's happening there is not forgiveness, but it's the kind of the emotional step that allows forgiveness to take place. So, because forgiveness is really hard, it's a process and it takes a lot of work. But part of that work is this psychological work of what I've called distancing, and what, like you're talking about in the context of this article, they're calling reframing.
Yeah.
So it's picturing it differently.
Yeah. Yeah. And what you kind of touched on this earlier in the discussion, but sort of the danger, I guess, is where reframing crosses into self-deception, right? And I think, to me, there's a difference in trying to deceive yourself about your actions versus deceiving yourself about the actions of others. Mm-hmm. And if you've spent 10 years treating people horribly and try to like shrug your shoulders and say, I guess I'll try to do better and I'll just kind of pretend a lot of that didn't happen. It'll probably continue to happen and it's probably not going to be good.
Right.
But I think if you have the ability to reframe the actions of others on you, to me, that seems a whole lot more healthy, I guess.
Yeah. Well, see, this is one of the ways I would say one of the reasons why if somebody harms you and you have not confronted them or discussed it with them, it's really hard to reframe it anyway, because it's hard to understand, like, why did they do it? What was their perspective? What's going on there? And so this is like, I had many years ago, I had a coworker who sent an email about me that was just malicious, and it was sent to some coworkers that, you know, people that I knew and work with on a regular basis. And one of those people forwarded the email that they'd received, and they said, like, is this true? Is this what's going on? I just got this email from so and so. I'm wondering, is this what's going on? And I read it and I thought, like I don't know where this came from. This is a person that sent the email that I thought I had a good working relationship, and here he is saying these terrible things about me that are just false. So I thought, I need to go talk to him. Otherwise I'm going to be angry at him forever, and I'm going to attribute real malicious motives to him, but I don't really know what's going on. Is it something he heard? So I went over to talk to him. I said, I'll call him Bob. I said, Bob, I just got a copy. This so-and-so sent me an email that you had sent to them, and it just lies. Like, why did you send it? And he just denied sending it.
Denied sending
it? Absolutely denied. I didn't send that. I never said those things about you. And then I was at a loss.
Yeah.
Like, what do I do then? But what I did is I thought I had to go talk to him, because I had to allow for the opportunity of some kind of reconciliation. But then I'm at a loss, because I thought, like, now he's engaged in some pretty deep self-deception. Like he seemed to be sincere, saying, like, I didn't.
He quickly reframed that.
He quickly reframed it. But then I think, now I can't trust this guy. Like, how do I work with him anymore?
Yeah.
And he ended up leaving the university like a few months after that. And so, fortunately, I didn't have to work with him anymore. This is why conflict is hard. And dealing with harms that we do to one another and that we experience from others is really hard. But there has to be some kind of coming together on a perspective. You have to be able to talk it through. And if we harm one another, acknowledge it. Forgive one another. If you can't do that, the relationship can't be repaired. And like that's where we were with this relationship. It was just like that was effectively the last time we ever worked together on anything.
We've talked a lot of times on this show in many different ways about how people are spending more and more time isolated from each other. In at home, people spend more time alone than they probably ever have in human history. And I think that just has to mean that people are having these internal conversations with themselves all the time, or much more often than they used to. And maybe the more we talk about this, I guess I've sort of adjusted my enthusiasm maybe for the meme a little bit, but I think it really comes down to knowing what you need to do. If you're a person who is too quick to dismiss your failings, and maybe even sometimes too quick to dismiss the failings of others, there's a path you can take. But I think what this meme was written about, I guess I was thinking maybe more about people I know, maybe more than me, but about people who, on the other side of that equation, have just a really hard time moving on and moving past things. And I think as people are having those internal conversations, I think it's good to know maybe which type of person you are and take the appropriate action. And I know that just sounds super easy, right? But to say, hey, I really find myself to be someone who's too easy to forgive and forget. So maybe I need to work on that. Or maybe I'm the person who never forgives and never forgets, and maybe I need to work on that. And I think maybe that is probably better advice than where the advice that maybe I started today's show off with. Does that sort of make sense?
Absolutely. And here's a like a way to put this that I think is kind of useful advice that I'll often give to people that are trying to, like, how do we work with other people in situations of conflict? And what I propose is a rule of thumb. Make sure you're spending more time talking with people than talking about them. And when you're having an internal dialogue, what you're doing is you're talking about people.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you only have, like, a few people that you confide in where you're gossiping about somebody else or you're sharing with others what so-and-so did, you're talking about people. It's okay to talk about other people occasionally. This is one of the ways in which we process what's going on. We figure out what to do and what's appropriate and how do we understand situations. But it should never be the dominant form of discussion. Like the dominant form of discussion should be talking with people. And when we're talking with people, we're also reframing, right? That's a kind of reframing because once I talk to you, like if we've had some disagreement or something and it's festered and now we're angry with one another, we talk with one another, what it does is cause us to rethink that situation and what each other's perspective is. And so that's a healthy mode of reframing, where oftentimes when we're talking about people, it's a very unhealthy way of reframing the event.
And I guess where I wanted to maybe end this conversation was maybe around where I think this can get to be the trickiest is when it comes around family dynamics, right? I've known families who have 3, 4, 5 siblings who I've been in their presence and they'll talk about what life was like growing up and they're all within several years of each other. And my goodness, do they have a sense of what that was like. And I think that is what can be so interesting. And I think does a little bit lend credence to the notion that the past is a little hazy or a little unclear sometimes, because you may have 4 siblings growing up in a home together with the same parents And 25 years later, their understanding of what that was like and the roles different people played can be really different. And I find that interesting. And it can be interesting, but it can also lead to a lot of disagreement or hurt feelings along the way, too, when you discuss some of those past memories.
I remember being fascinated by this as a child, by observing the different ways my dad's family and my mother's family both engaged with one another and recounted their histories. Because on my dad's side of the family, they talked about one another all the time. They had very different stories about growing up, very different perspectives. My mom's side of the family, they had not as many people in the family, but they had similar kind of age range. They had different experiences growing up, but they all knew what those different experiences were because they talked to each other all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a kind of consistency to them where my dad's side of the family, they all had a different perspective and they all held grudges and there's all these shifting alliances and it was very confusing and also fascinating. And it just gave me this insight from a very young age of like how these different kinds of dynamics work within groups of people and just different ways of talking to one another that create very different perspectives on shared events.
And especially as people, kids grow, get out of the home and start living different lives. And then it's just, I find it even also interesting. I mean, there's been countless films made about this, right? Where you have 30 and 40 something year old adult children coming back for the holidays and all bringing back, you know, everything from failing relationships to somebody lost a job to somebody is extremely wealthy and all these different things come back. And then you have to kind of force these people back together around a Thanksgiving or table or a Christmas tree. And then that's when I think part of the current situations they're all in can greatly influence how they think about the past, right? I would think that a lot of, and my guess would be, and I don't know if I'm right, but maybe you'll tell me, is that the people who are generally miserable in their life today are more likely to think they had a miserable upbringing than the people who are pretty happy with their lives and then are probably look back at their childhood a lot more fondly.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And probably part of it is the development of this, that the skills that you were talking about of reframing.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes we can grow up into people who are continually bringing to mind the very worst memories and the worst interpretation of different events on us. And I think like a healthy life is one in which we reconcile in some way, we accommodate the past, both the good and the bad elements, but then we continue to move forward and focus on how can I live each day a little bit better?
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, I hear you have a question for me.
So pretty simple dilemma for you, Scott. Let's say you're visiting an old friend, and the friend offers you a beer, serves you beer in an aluminum can, and you both drink your beers. And when you get done, you ask, so where should I put the can? And your friend says, oh, just toss it in the trash. We don't recycle anything. But I don't know if you are a recycler.
I am a recycler. Absolutely.
You are a recycler.
Yes, absolutely am.
So if you're somebody who recycles and thinks that that is a good thing to do and you ought to do it, what do you do in this case?
So it's interesting because as we're talking about this, we're sitting around a table, and earlier in the show, I finished off a peach-flavored water. It was in a plastic bottle, and you have a lime
sparkling
water in a can, right?
Yep.
So I'll ask you, I promise to get to your dilemma in a second, but what I'm going to do, and I would do this whether we were talking about this or not, when I'm packing up and I have my laptop next to me and we're going to, I'm going to go home. I presume you're going to go home probably too. I would naturally just take my plastic bottle with me. And when I get pulling the car in the garage, toss it in the recycle bin, which presently is in the garage. And that's just what I would do. So I'll ask first before I answer the question you ask, what are you going to do with that aluminum can sitting in front of you?
Yeah, I'm going to take it home with me. Okay. Toss it in the recycling bin.
Because we're in an office that we're not all that familiar with. Is there recycling here? Maybe. Is it between here and the door we use? No. So, I mean, we could probably wander around and maybe find a recycle bin. But in both cases, we're going to take it home and toss it in our own.
And I'll just mention that one of the reasons I choose drinks in aluminum cans is because it's very efficiently recycled, unlike plastic.
Well, and see, now that goes to exactly my next point, is that I had a conversation with somebody just the other day who knows way, way, way more about these things than me. And I asked him, I said, you know, am I right to say that although many people like me recycle plastic and put it in the bin just like you're supposed to, that the majority of that never really ends up being recycled at all? And his response, and he's in a position to know, said it certainly varies by municipality and there's a number of variables depending on where you live, but generally the estimate is about 15 to 20% of plastic that you put in the recycle bin actually gets recycled.
That's really low.
And again, that's the amount of that people actually choose to put in the bin. I mean, there's obviously plenty of stuff that ends up just in the trash can or what have you. Now, I'm old enough to remember that aluminum cans, and I don't know if these even still exist. I don't think they do, but that was like one of the very first things, not only that people were encouraged to recycle, but you could get like a little money back from it. And I think those, I mean, I even still see, I think, maybe you can tell me if this still exists in our city, but these little cages where people will like bag up their aluminum cans and dump them in a like donation bin, and then some nonprofit will collect enough over weeks and months to like bring it to some facility and turn that into a little bit of money. Is that still go on?
That still goes on. And then there are some states.
Yes, Iowa has it built into it, mm-hmm. and has since I was like a teenager.
And I think Michigan pays the most. Isn't it like 10 cents a bottle or can?
So there's a long way to get to your question. Of all the, setting aside like car batteries and things like that, which are, you know, highly dangerous and should be recycled and that, but like just regular household products, aluminum is the most highly recyclable thing we have. And yes, you're exactly right to say that your seltzer water in a can from an environmental standpoint is heads and tails. No, what's the saying? Is well above on an environmental scale, well above my plastic bottle.
And what's more above either one of them is just having a water bottle.
Having something you can just reuse time after time after time. So getting through all of that, this is a friend I'm sitting with I guess you outlined this as an old friend and he gives you a can of beer. And I can't think of the last time I've had a beer out of a can, but we'll move past that for now. If that was his response, like, oh, I don't believe in recycling, or we don't believe in recycling as his response. I mean, if this is, unless this is like has up until this point, you know, during the time of drinking the beer, unless this has just been a miserable, awful conversation, whereas the entire time I'm thinking, gosh, I don't know why I'm paying any attention to this friend. I can't wait to leave. Assuming I have not gotten to that point. And the question about recycling comes up. That seems like the next conversation we're going to have. I'm like, oh, you don't believe in recycling. Well, I would talk to him about, well, I can understand where, you know, plastic has some problems and we should all probably go out of our way to use less plastic in the world. But aluminum cans, I mean, they've been recycling those since I was a kid. And because the reason they have value is because they're like, that's a commodity that there's an interest in. And I would like want to learn more about that. So to me, that is a conversation starter, not a conversation ender.
If the friend is not persuadable.
If the friend
after your conversation.
Oh, if the friend's not persuadable. Well, then that makes it even easier. So I've like raised my hand and told my friend that I think he's wrong and that recycling aluminum is like undeniably a good thing. I'm not going to just say, oh, well, except for today, I'll just throw it in your trash under the sink. And of course, at that point, I'm going to absolutely say, no, 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 I'll just take this with me. A, because it's the right thing to do, and B, to make the point that I was making to him just a few minutes earlier.
Yeah.
So that, yeah. So, I mean, I would use that as a conversation point, and then I would take the can with me. And
just like you are going to hear.
Yeah, just like I would. And there's times like, you know, Travis and I will be like on a trip somewhere, and, you know, maybe we'll collect some recyclable garbage, and what we'll, you know, we'll often just sort of keep it on the floor of the back seat until we get home, and then we get home and toss it in the recycle bin in the garage and move on from there. So this would be a pretty easy, I just wouldn't be like, oh, you know, recycle here, that's fine. I mean, that seems like weird, especially around aluminum, and I would talk about that. So what would you do?
This came up because I was visiting a friend recently, but it's somebody I know. Like, we have disagreements on a whole range of things, and this is one of them that I've known about before. And at the end of it, I just thought, oh, it's just one can. I'd toss it in the trash, and then I was thinking, why didn't I take that home? That friend already knows we disagree about with this. I didn't bring it up for a whole discussion. We were talking about other things.
Yeah.
But I was thinking, you know, why didn't I just take it with me instead of going along? And I was thinking, just because it's just easier sometimes to go along and not create the conflict, right?
Yeah.
But I'm not surprised by your reaction because you don't seem to mind that kind of conflict.
And it's like, you know, and to me, it's not a subjective thing. I mean, it's like, I'm not going to argue with somebody like that they don't like blueberry muffins. I mean, I like blueberry muffins. Maybe you don't. I mean, whatever. That's fine. There's no like moral judgment here. But like, if it's something that's and even like there's even some political issues you can like have a disagreement on, but like, there's like both sides too, but to say like recycling has no purpose, especially around aluminum, I mean, that's just wrong. And I just think that that's like, I would feel in very comfortable position there of telling him he's wrong. And I'm certainly not an expert on recycling, but I certainly know that if people are paying you to take your garbage, because that means it has value and that they're doing that and reusing it for a reason.
Well, I agree with you completely, by the way, because I like blueberry muffins, but but when it comes to blueberry bagels, those are just objectively wrong. There's something like wrong with people who like those.
Yeah,
that's objective. That's not a matter of taste.
I can't remember the last time I had a blueberry bagel, but I could see having one if it were toasted with some plain cream cheese. That sounds okay.
Yeah, they have that. It's like a purple dye that permeates them.
It's called a blueberry, Rick. You know, but you're okay with blueberry muffins?
Yeah, that's completely different.
Huh. So okay, since we have a minute here, what is your, I mean, if I can guess what your favorite muffin is, and I'm guessing it's not blueberry. I'm going to guess, I bet you're a lemon poppy seed guy.
No.
Really?
Not, no.
What is your favorite? What's your go-to muffin?
Anything with cinnamon.
Oh, that's
like
a perfect
apple cinnamon.
Or like a coffee cake kind
coffee
of
cake, cinnamon,
muffin.
Anything with cinnamon.
Okay, yeah. That's a perfectly and just so that means we're coming into your season.
Apple pie season. But not pumpkin spice. Man, that's the one thing that's almost ruined fall for me.
Well, the one thing, and I know this is way off ethics, and I'm sure, if anybody's still listening, God bless you. But if there's one thing we could change, and I think you'll be with me on this, Rick, is what is a seasonal product that should not be a seasonal product? Cinnamon ice cream. You can buy it. There's usually like 2 months of the year. You can buy cinnamon ice cream.
It is delicious.
It is delicious.
It should be year-round.
It should be year-round.
If it was year-round, I would eat a lot more ice cream.
Yeah. I think that is one of the underappreciated ice cream flavors, and I don't think that's like a regional thing to hear. I just think people just think about it in like October and November, and then it gets clearanced out, and then they bring in like the peppermint ice cream for Christmas, and then, you know, we have to suffer through January with just our regular ice creams.
Yeah, this has turned into a very interesting ethical dilemma. Thank you, Scott.
Well, we'll try to touch on more. And the last thing I do want to say, by the way, is we're in nearing September. We have gone more than 8 months without any parking dilemmas for me, which I think was my resolution for the year.
Okay, so, I'll have one in 2 weeks.
Oh, well, that, dear listener, is a reason to tune back in.
Okay.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And when Rick is not eating a blueberry muffin, he is writing columns about ethics, and each of those can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for listening.